to start the year public first public health meeting of 2019. Did everybody get a chance to review the meeting notes, and is there a motion to?
Motion to approve.
Second.
We've got a new member, Katie Nguyen. Very excited to have her here. She is replacing Amy Bishop Smith, who is now off to college. And we're really excited. Katie is a current member of the Youth Commission and has an interest in youth substance use prevention and environmental public health. That may change. She's got a pretty broad range. And, we talked to her. She's got a lot of things on her plate, so we're kind of excited for her to develop all the new interests. So this could be one of them. She's a sophomore at Henry and the Bioscience High School, and her studies are focused on healthcare and environmental public health. And this may change too, but at this point, it sounds like oncology is something that you're excited about learning and having an interest in. I'm very excited to have you here. Thank you for spending some time with us. Welcome. And probably go around and do our introductions, because we also have another special attendant here. And then we have a member from the public, too, so maybe we can go around and introduce each other. So I'll start. I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I'm a veterinarian practicing in Clark County.
I'm David Hudson. I'm the Health and Communities Manager for Clark County Public Health.
Remy Houston, representing the dental community here in Clark County.
Stephanie Rossi-Mashta. I'm a nurse practicing in Clark County.
Dave Fuller with Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency.
I'm Roxanne Wolf. I'm staff with Public Health.
I'm Jeff Robinson, Administrative Services Director of Public Health.
I'm Martin Snubble. I serve as the CMO for South Southwest.
Janice
Cutts,
I'm the Environmental
Public
Health Director.
John Braw, Clark Public Utilities, Clark County Water Provider.
Mark Collier, representing septic installers, designers, and maintenance people.
Melanie Meyerino, representing Clark County Social Human Services Agency.
Paul Childers, I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
I'm Lydia Gurman with Public Health.
Hi, I'm Joan Cayley. I'm a community health nurse, but I sit on this council as the non-elected representative from the City of Vancouver.
I'm Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief at Battleground. I represent the Law Enforcement Council, which is all seven police chiefs in the county, plus the sheriff.
Hi, Alan Melnick, Public Health Director and Health Officer.
I'm Jeannie Stewart, and my last term of office was on the Clark County Council, and that ended December 31st. So I really appreciate it. An invitation to come even after my term. Thank you for that.
Do we have any comments from the public?
I'm Deanna Dunto. I'm a nurse working in the community. I'm just here to observe and see what community has to offer for healthy lifestyle.
And I am Sam Weaver. I'm assistant to the ombuds and professional rock and roller.
So, Councilor Stewart, it's very nice to have you here, and I know that Alan would like to say a little bit more, but I do have a little thank you. Do you want me to do that, Alan, or do you want to do your...
Well, you go ahead, and then I'll follow you. That's
that sounds good.
You're the formal presenter.
That's I guess so. So, on behalf of the Public Health Advisory Council, I want to recognize and thank Councilor Jeannie Stewart for her years of service in our community and our ongoing support of the public health mission. Councilor Stewart joined Clark County Council in 2014, and prior to that, she served on the Vancouver City Council for 12 years. She has been actively involved with many community boards and councils, including CTRAN, the Columbia River Economic Development Council, Regional Transportation Council, and the Solid Waste Advisory Council. She has also been very active in supporting neighborhood associations, co-founding the Carter Park Neighborhood Association, and serving as chair in the Vancouver Neighborhood Alliance, both of which have been key in the development of safe and engaged communities. We have a small token of our appreciation to Councilor Stewart for all of her efforts on behalf of our community and public health. Thank you very much.
We have the...
We have the... No, you do it.
This is heavy. You can use it again. So this is for you. But I just want to, I don't have prepared comments. I just want to say a few words. I've been the health officer in many different counties in two different states, and I've worked with a variety of boards and commissioners and elected officials. And you are honestly one of the top folks. You're one of my favorite. Your integrity, there was never any doubt why you were there. You were there to serve the public, and you exemplified public service. I didn't always like the questions you asked. You were asking the right questions because you were trying to be informed, and you were trying to do your duty as a public servant. And they were good questions, and I've always appreciated them, and I always appreciated your dedication to public service. I think the world of you, and it's been an honor to work for you as your health officer.
I have to say, it's been my honor. We're lucky to have you. We're so lucky to have the Public Health Commission, all of you who are willing to serve. Some of you are committed or subscribed to it. Some of you are volunteers. Before I came, I wanted to remind myself what kinds of things this commission does. And I'm afraid the list is probably from 2015, but it's not old information. So the ACEs program, even in 2015, you were talking about that. The budget crisis and how we continue to provide effective public health with limited budgets, decreasing budgets, and a lot of competition for budgets, but nevertheless emphasizing how important the public health aspect of the budget is. Children's health, concerns about meth use, and we have a lot in the news right now that reminds us that meth and substitutions for these drugs it's a dangerous, dangerous circumstances. There are other things on here, but the other one that has been something that I've worked on for at least 30 years, and that's protection of groundwater. And I helped write on the Planning Commission of Vancouver the very first ordinances that outlined zones of contribution and what kinds of chemicals could not be used within proximity of wellheads. So please keep up that work. I know you will. And if you ever need me to come out of retirement and help you advocate for something, I'm all over it. So thank you so much. I am going to exit. I apologize. I have two more places to be, but thank you all for the great job you do here. Yeah.
Presented to you in November, did not have any reductions for public health. So that was good news, and we'll definitely keep you apprised as the 2020 budget development process develops. I think that was probably it on the budget and fees, unless there are questions, specific questions about the budget.
What's your total budget, just out of curiosity?
Both funds, about 13 or 14 million.
Jeff, you said it was a little bit challenging for the environmental health fees?
Just the process in general. It's a long process.
Yeah, okay, it's a long process, but...
Yeah, discussions with advisory commissions, one-on-one with county counselors, a work session with county counselors, a new county manager coming in, budget, I wouldn't call it a crisis, but budget concerns, wanting to move to a more of a... where we cover more of our costs. So, yeah, it was definitely a challenging process this year.
So the fees that were passed were what you had talked with us about?
Yeah.
Okay.
You want me to talk about I can talk about it. I can't remember where we were last time we met, but you may all recall that we've been working with the State Department of Health and our local public health colleagues across the state around adequate funding for public health and foundational public health services. And I think the last time we met was probably before the governor's budget came out. So basically what our original ask was, we had done this, just to do this in a few sentences or less, all the local health jurisdictions in the state, as well as the State Department of Health, took a look at what services they were providing in terms of foundational public health services and where the gaps are. And the foundational public health services are in the areas around communicable disease control, environmental health, and assessment. And those are the basic ones. We identified a gap of about over $400 million a biennium. Our ask, original ask, was going to be to ask the legislature for $296 million for the biennium. But we're doing this in collaboration with the governor and the State Department of Health. You might recall in the last session, the last legislative session 2 years ago, we got a one-time deal of $12 million. This time we're asking for $296 million ongoing. The governor's budget finally came out, and it included $22 million for foundational public health services. So it's a lot less than what we asked for, but it's also ongoing funding, so that's a good thing. The governor, the State Department of Health can't advocate for more than that, but local public health and our partners are going to be going to the legislature and asking them to put a bit more in than the $22 million. So we'll keep you posted on that. We might... We're one of the things we're doing is we're working with local health departments. We're working with their boards of health to pass a resolution supporting foundational public health services, because that will be effective in terms of lobbying and working with the legislature. On council time for Wednesday, we have a mock-up of a resolution that we're going to show to them, and hopefully at the board of health hearing next week, we may actually have a resolution on the Board of Health, for the Board of Health to vote on in terms of a resolution supporting foundational public health services. So we can keep you guys posted on that. I don't know if there are any questions.
Not a question, but the governor in his State of the State addressed mental health and public health, and also facing up against the NRA and gun control. So I thought those were some of the things that we discussed recently.
Yeah, unfortunately, we only got $22 million for funding, There's a lot of other things on the budget we're competing with this year.
Right.
Alan, can you explain to me exactly what foundational includes?
Yeah, it includes both services as well as called capabilities, and there's a website you can go to called Public Health is Essential, and it'll give you more detail. But communicable disease control, like when we're right now responding to a measles outbreak, those kind of services, what we do in terms of disease control, immunizations, those are considered foundational. They really, they're the kind of services that only government is because they're issues that affect the entire population, mm-hmm. not just one group, mm-hmm. like communicable disease. And they're also related to our authority or our state statute and power to actually investigate and control communicable disease. Mm-hmm. So that's a foundational public health service. Everybody should have access to that. Our environmental health service is another example. They're mandated services. They need to be available to everybody, you know, businesses as well as individuals mm-hmm. throughout the state. Those are very foundational. And then things like the assessment is a foundational capability, because our ability to take a look at what are the health issues in the community are pretty fun. So like even being able to identify, for example, the ongoing opioid epidemic or figuring out what's killing us or what chronic disease are affecting us, or really the ability to assess that on a population-wide, you know, every resident in the state, this report in our community is really a foundational public health ability. I don't know if that explains it.
Yes,
well,
it does. But I just want to make sure
it's different than other services, which are also important, but not necessarily foundational, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
So the $22 million is for the foundational support, and then there's other money budgeted for programs like the I can't think of the newborn.
Nurse Found.
Right.
So that would be considered an additional important service, but not a foundational public health service.
Okay. So
the $22 million is for foundational. And I'll give you an example of where the gaps are. First of all, one of the gaps is our ability to get immunization rates up, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing measles right now. Another example is the fact that we're not getting to all the sexually transmitted disease rates have been going up markedly over the last several years, and those increases are sustained. We're not getting to all the gonorrhea, especially chlamydia, that we should be getting to. We had a couple of cases of congenital syphilis a couple of years ago, so we don't have the resources to do as good a job in sexually transmitted disease as we might otherwise. Tuberculosis is another one where we have resources for the active cases, but for people who are infected, we call it latent TB infection, we don't have the resources to get them to identify all those folks and get them treated. So there's areas where we can be doing a lot better than we are.
Okay, thank you.
So state funding right now makes up about 20.5% of our budget, just to put that into numbers. That we're obviously not very well funded by the state.
Okay.
Who's our role?
You want to go?
It's up to you. You're the boss.
You're the next
vote. Yeah. I'll try to be brief. For those of you who've been following, or maybe not, the county is doing some reorganization, and one of the programs, one of the county programs, is the medical examiner's office, and that's been moved into our department. So the medical examiner is a program that basically investigates unnatural and unexplained deaths in the county, and that includes forensic pathology. So those are the physicians, pathologists actually do the autopsies. They work very closely with law enforcement, the prosecuting attorney and all that, and identifying, you know, if you have an unexplained or an unnatural death, being able to identify whether there's some, you know, maybe there's some foul play involved as well, and there's some issues there. The medical examiner's office has involved up till now two forensic pathologists. They have five investigators who actually gather data and go to the scene. Actually, forensic pathologists go to the scene, the death scene as well. And they have a couple of autopsy assistants. So those folks are now in our department. I think the only local health jurisdiction in the state that has a medical examiner in their department is Seattle, King County. There's not all counties have medical examiners, only the larger ones do. The smaller ones have coroners, and they will send their autopsy cases, if necessary, to other jurisdictions that have medical examiners. There's all kinds of opportunity to work with the medical examiner, because the office is going to be a really great opportunity here. I think an example of where we could work really closely, and you've already heard about child death review, but being able to look at, to get more data and actually look at, and we'll bring some of that to the Public Health Advisory Council, because there might be some recommendations. Once we identify risk factors, we may be able to identify some recommendations that we can make about how to prevent these things from happening. Another example is, through our contract with the state, we were able to get, there was funding available for, I don't know if it's a spectrophotometer or what, but it's a device that's going to allow us to identify drugs on board. Instead of waiting for weeks for this to go to lab, we'll be able to identify, do some toxicology right on site. And that's really exciting, especially when we're thinking about the overdose deaths and newer variations of fentanyl coming into the community. So that'll be really, I'm really kind of excited about that.
And would that be under an unnatural?
Yeah, an overdose. Is
and a suicide under, would also be?
Oh, yeah.
Those are
some
of our big topics for the next
year. Yeah, the medical examiner will investigate all the suicides in the... Another example is, if you have a sudden infant death, that they may examine it, they look into that too, because not all SIDS ends up being really SIDS, so.
And is that office, so they will have the autopsies done in this building, or where is that?
No, oh, that, thank you for pointing that out. So the staff are over in the Public Service Center, but the autopsies are done at a building down Franklin Street, several blocks west.
So they will move that.
We will not be moving folks over here.
And they'll stay in their same building, they just are underneath the umbrella, different umbrella.
Well, I was impressed there when you talked about it last time. They do over 300 autopsies here in this county.
Yeah,
it was just amazing, the number. So.
Well, yeah. We got almost half a million.
300 per year.
Any questions about the medical exam? We could probably arrange tours at some point if you want some time in the morgue.
I went to the LA County morgue before, no thanks. In the old days, they'd be stacked 40, and then crime lab was upstairs, and this is a long time ago, so I don't want to gross anybody out. So but I will say anyway.
Okay.
In order to fingerprint the bodies, they didn't want to transport the body upstairs, so they just took what they needed to run the roll fingerprints back in the old days. They would cut them off, bag them.
Oh.
So now that you've told that story, I can tell you, I knew a forensic pathologist in another state who used to love having law enforcement folks around, because she'd do the autopsy, and they would just pass out around.
Do they still have, the drawers? I remember that.
Yeah, they got all the juice. It's not quite, is it CSI, but they have things like bone saws and stuff like that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Quincy.
Quincy.
We have our own Quincy. So do you think we might be able to meet one of these?
I think what we could do, if you guys are interested, just like we bring other programs and staff here, we're gonna probably have them bring them in front of the Board of Health. I don't, it's up to you guys, but I don't think there's any reason why, we couldn't have you meet some of the, I don't know, Roxanne, what you think?
Well, especially with their connection with, the mass casualty work that we're doing with their emergency response team, with the child death review. I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff that really are vital records. I mean, you do a lot, it dovetails nicely with a lot of the work we do. So, yeah, I think probably going to be later in the year as we're trying to work on this transition. It was effective at the beginning of this year, so we're still trying to figure stuff out.
You mean 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, 3 weeks ago.
And thanks for bringing up.
They're fully integrated now.
Thanks for bringing up the mass casualty plan, because when there is a disaster and the bodies start stacking up, you do need to have a plan for that, and that they're part of that. Yeah, it's another example of where we work together.
I recall several years ago, and I don't know why I was there, but I actually toured that little building down the street, and what I remember about it was how tiny it was and how it's very crowded. So there's no way all of us would be able to tour it. It's just this very small space.
You can go feel free.
Oh, you don't want your little PC now?
No, I don't.
Apparently, at one point, it was like a bar or something. Or
I said this to Remy. It looks like a dentist's office to me from the other side.
We're basically the same principle.
Not that extreme.
It didn't look like the big spacious labs on TV, like on CSI, they're big places.
Oh, yeah.
Ours
yeah.
is just not that, it's not like the TV.
Okay. But we've got the little sliding drawers, right?
They have shelves.
There are jars filled with different organs and stuff.
Yeah. It's very new for us.
I could talk about this stuff.
Yeah, but we can definitely have a...
You don't want to hear it.
That would be really neat.
Yep. I know there's really tiny images, so... All right, great. Okay, so accreditation? Okay. So we wanted to give you a quick update on where we are with accreditation, and we've decided to stop our efforts for the time being around there, not full-blown efforts, but I just want to give you a little bit of background. So accreditation in general is a quality improvement kind of an effort. And the goal anytime that you go through accreditation is you look for, what's working, what's not, where are the gaps, that sort of thing. And it's been great so far. There's 12 domains that we, for the public health accreditation, that we have to go through and take a look at. And there are a variety of different areas that we have to look at in depth. And what this process has been able to show us is that we definitely have some gaps in our system. We don't, what we found is that a lot of the work that accreditation requires, we are actually doing, but we don't document it well. And so you've heard the old adage, if it's not documented, it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So one of the gaps we found is that we really do need to put systems in place in order to document the work that we're doing, in order to not only show that we're doing it, but also to sustain it going forward. And what we felt, there's a lot of stuff going on right now. We have some capacity issues right now. We also lost half of our accreditation team, mighty team of two, that were helping to facilitate this. So 50% of our team is now gone. And so we really felt like we needed to bring some more resources around this to do it well and to do it right. And not only just to check off the boxes, we did that. We want to really sustain it as well. The effort will continue in that we are continuing to use those standards to build those systems that we need, and at such time that we're ready, then we will go through the accreditation process at that time. But some of the things that we're doing is really around performance management and really bringing resources around performance management and structuring and reporting around that. Another thing is our workforce development plan. We have a plan in place, but it's not as robust as it needs to be. Our communications plan, our new PIO has been working diligently on that, so that's another area. And there are a few other areas as well, but we're in the process. The intent originally was that we would start sending in all of our documentation starting in January, and we would have a site visit this year. We are gonna postpone it. We don't know how long yet it will be postponed, and we're still kind of working through that to determine if we can bring on some additional resources around this, we can do it sooner. But if we're not gonna be able to bring on some additional resources, it's gonna take us a little bit longer. We're gonna continue to use the foundation to build the systems we need. It's great, we're very excited about it. And we want this effort to continue, but we also, like I said, want to be able to sustain it. We don't wanna just get accredited once and then have to go through building a wheel again in 5 years. So that's what we're doing. I just wanna give you a quick update. We'll continue to update you as time goes on and anything changes around that. So any questions around that or?
I think it's smart. What you don't want to do is do a less than stellar job,
exactly.
Be denied accreditation,
exactly.
And or get an accreditation with some kind of stipulations with it. So, and I think it's just wiser, because it's not just about the accreditation, as you said. It's about the internal systems and making sure that they're quality and sustainable.
Yeah, and we literally found that much of it. Vast majority of the work we're already doing, but it's just around that, those systemic pieces that need to be in place to sustain it. So, yeah. Thank you. All right, thanks, guys.
Start with flu. We're going alphabetical order. So, we thought we were, by definition, we define flu season as 10% or more of specimens positive for influenza. So the week before last, we reached the 11.4% level, and we thought we were heading into flu season, but we really require from our definition, 2 weeks, consecutive weeks. And lo and behold, this past week we dropped to 9.2%. So that was a week between the 6th and the 12th. So, I mean, it's probably going to go up again, and we're basically entering the flu season here in Clark County, but we're, you know, it can fluctuate, and generally, if you look at past years, the trend is upwards. Our partners, our community partners, like our hospitals, use their own, they determine when they're going to institute their policies and when it's flu season. I know Peace Health has already instituted a while ago, which is great. I mean, I think it's good that you guys did that, but so far, then, you know, we're slowly getting into it this year. Some flu seasons occur later than others, and we've seen influenza as late, you know, as mid-spring. Those of you who haven't gotten your flu shot yet, it takes 2 weeks to build up immunity. We're still recommending people get their flu shots. But so far, it's been a slow increase so far this year.
Can you tell whether the vaccine rates have gone up this year? Is that something that data is not really...
Yeah, there's no way to for us to really measure.
To know how many.
It's not notifiable. Yeah.
Has there been any indication that the flu, the actual sick, the itself, that it's lasting longer than it has in the past?
Not that I know of. We don't have any evidence that it's either, you know, if you get influenza, it's either more severe or less severe than previous years.
Or that it's lasting. I mean, I'm just worried about people getting sick and staying sick and it like resurging and there's more likelihood of infection.
Well, you're contagious before your symptoms become severe. But you know, the other recommendation for folks is if you first of all, you should get the vaccine to, you know, that not only reduces your likelihood of getting the flu, but it also, if you do get it, it reduces the severity and it reduces the likelihood of hospitalization and death. But there's also medications you can take that are most effective within 48 hours. So if you do have symptoms, you think you might be the flu, it's a good idea not to go in necessarily, but to call your healthcare provider and speak to them about that. We want people to stay home if they can, if they do have the flu, instead of infecting others. Yes?
So to Marjorie's point, could flu also end up becoming more severe in that it ends up in some respiratory distress or pneumonia or something?
Oh, what are the complications?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, pneumonia is most serious, you know, one of the most serious complications. The other thing that, so every year in the U.S., tens of thousands of people, depending on the year, will die of influenza. Influenza itself can cause pneumonia, but it can also do other things. So, for example, if you have congestive heart, you know, if you're living with some congestive heart failure, influenza can be enough to put you over the edge and make that worse and kill you. So there are a lot of complications of influenza. It can be a really deadly disease. I don't know if that was answering.
My concerns are just my parents are getting older. They're in their 80s, and I'm very concerned about them.
They should certainly get the flu shot. Still the most effective way to prevent flu.
I brought my dad with a hammer to get him a flu shot. So just that.
Did he get it?
He did.
All right.
And I got him a burger from Burgerville.
they don't have the nasal mist anymore.
It's not indicated. So there is this year, but it's not for elderly people. It's
okay.
Age is, I think, 2 to 50, if I remember correctly. And Lawrence, Dr. Neville can correct me if I'm incorrect.
You actually don't remember.
It's 2 to 50. 2 to 49.
So over 50s elderly.
You're out. Yeah. Okay. Should I talk about measles? So you may have heard on the news, and we've done press releases as well, that we have an outbreak of measles. Now you may want to ask, how do we define what an outbreak is? The epidemiologic definition of outbreak is when you have observed cases that are more than what would be expected, basically. And we really haven't had measles there's one exception I'll tell you, but since 2011 there hasn't been a measles case in Clark County, except last summer we believe we had a measles case. It fit the clinical definition. It was actually a contact to an actual confirmed case,
But the lab confirmation was never available, so the state is not considering it as a confirmed case. But generally, we do not have, in most years, virtually all years, we don't have measles in Clark County. So even one case is basically an outbreak. And the other concern about measles is, it sounds, the name doesn't sound really severe, but measles itself can be a really deadly disease. It's effective, the vaccine, two doses of vaccine are 97% effective, so it's a very effective vaccine. But measles has some really nasty complications, including a pneumonia and encephalitis, which is a swelling of the brain. Before the vaccination era for measles in the early 60s, every year in the United States, somewhere between, there were several million cases, and every year between 400 and 500 people in the United States died from measles. I just want to get that point across. That's like two jumbo jets crashing every year. 500 people died from measles, and there were 4,000 hospitalizations on average every year due to encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain. So people take some of this stuff for granted. You might see stuff on social media saying measles is not a big deal. It is a big deal. And by the way, before the vaccine era, about 48,000 on average hospitalizations every year in the United States from measles. So that, to me, is a pretty significant consideration, especially when we have a vaccine that's incredibly safe and incredibly effective. So far this year, well, this is hot off the press. Until yesterday, we had three confirmed cases. We had that one child who you might have read about was at Memorial Urgent Care on the 31st of December and was at the Memorial Urgent Care when they were contagious. And the other point I want to make about measles, which is why I'm concerned about where our cases are going, is that measles is exquisitely contagious. It's one of the most contagious infections there is. And you can be in a room, if you're susceptible, you haven't been vaccinated or you aren't old like me and had measles as a kid, if you're susceptible, you can be in a room 2 hours after somebody with measles left and still get infected. So it's exquisitely contagious. So we had this one child who was at Memorial Urgent Care when contagious. And oh, the other point I want to make, I'm sorry, I'm blabbering and you can shut me up, but the symptoms of measles early on, the first few days, the symptoms are fever, cough, runny nose, and red eye, which could be, you know, pink eyes, which could be a lot of things, but you're contagious during that period. You may not know you have measles until the rash appears, which can be 4 days later. So you're contagious during those first several days as well as 4 days after the rash begins. So people end up going to places like Memorial Urgent Care when they're contagious. And what we had to do, and Memorial Urgent Care was great. Peace Health was really wonderful about this. We had to, we had this child, we're investigating this case. We had to identify who was in the urgent care clinic, either from ranging from a half hour before until 2 hours after this child left. This is why we need funding for foundational public health services. I'm going to give you an idea of the work involved with that one case. We were able to identify a number of people who were, thanks to the sign-in and the patient roster, we could identify people who were exposed. We had to interview them and not only assess their immune status, but we had to ask them if they brought anybody else with them to the who might not have signed in, like another family member or friend who came with them to the visit. We had to identify those folks. And for that one case, I think we had 80 contacts that we had to interview. Then we had, more recently, we had two cases that went through the Portland airport. You may have heard about that. As of this afternoon, and think of the work in the first case, as of this afternoon, we have 14 confirmed cases that we're working on. So we've gone into incident command today. We've set up an incident command structure because this thing is pretty big, and it may get bigger. By the way, one of the cases earlier had been hospitalized with dehydration and fever. So that, you know, we've already had one hospitalization of this in a child. But now we have 14 confirmed cases that we're investigating. So large number, most of them, if not all of them, the rest are unimmunized. So we have, the other point I want to make is, So many, these are kids, and many of them, virtually all of them have been in school, including the time when they were contagious. So we're actually, today we've issued exclusion orders for schools in a couple of school districts, Evergreen and Vancouver School District, specific schools where we know the cases have been. We're excluding children and staff who are unimmunized or underimmunized. So that we're trying to stop this, given as contagious as it is. We also have another Cornerstone Christian School where we've had a case, and we're excluding there. Did you have a question?
I just wanted to say that when Sam was in school, if he didn't get his immunization, if he didn't get all his shots, he couldn't go to school. How is it that these children are getting, I mean, exemptions are fine, I guess, but what parent wouldn't want their child to be immunized? Yeah,
well, you can go on to our Facebook posting and see.
I mean, I see all that, but
Yeah, you know, so the schools, if you want to know what the immunization rates in schools are, there's a really, you can go on to this DOH, State Department of Health, and we can get you the link to that. You can actually look at the immunization rates by school, by school building. In Washington State, different states have different laws about immunization exclusion. Washington State has fairly liberal laws about that, so you can get a medical exemption. Those are really rare, very small number of medical exemptions. You can get a religious exemption. Those are really rare also, because there aren't many religions that are you can certify that are opposed to immunization. The vast majority of exemptions, the vast, vast majority of exemptions are called philosophical or personal exemptions. Washington tightened the law a few years ago. A few years ago, you could just sign in when, you know, at the school, if your parents say, I philosophically or personally oppose it. Now you're required to get a note from a healthcare provider saying that you you heard the talk about, that your provider has spoken to you about immunizations. But we still, you can still get to school without those. So there are some schools, so for measles, given how contagious it is, you need at least, you need well north of 90% of folks immunized to have what's called herd immunity to stop spread. There are schools in Clark County that are way below 90%, and you could look at it on the state website. You can actually go to Clark County and look at the schools.
So, do these written exclusions come to public health?
No, they go to the school.
How
school knows what the immunization status of their kids are?
How? I mean, it seems like we could get a. There's got to be some doctor or doctors that are healthcare professionals that are signing this and like find out who's doing it the most. It's like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers when they were trying to find out which judges were letting people off of DUI sentences.
You don't approve, as a doctor, as a healthcare provider, you don't approve the exemption. You just sign a form saying you had the discussion with the parent about. Oh. That's all the parents need to bring. They need to bring a form saying, I signed by the doctor saying, I gave, you know, Jane Doe or John Doe, you know, parents immunization about, I gave them information about immunization. We had the talk. And the parent says, I had the talk with my child's doc, and I still don't want my child to have immunization. It's not the healthcare providers are just signing the form saying they had that discussion. That's all it is.
Well.
That's Washington law.
That's Oregon's too, I think.
Oregon and Washington, I don't keep up with that. They have the Pacific Northwest is fairly kind of has lax rules about that. But now these kids are going to be excluded, and actually the unimmunized kids, we can't even give them one shot and let them back in school because with measles you can have a reaction to the shot. It might you won't know whether it's just a reaction to the shot or the measles itself at first. So they have to be excluded for the full the incubation period is any. From the time of exposure to the onset of symptoms is anywhere from 7 days to 21 days. And then if we have more cases in that school, we extend it out. So some of these kids could be out of school for a while.
Did
Have you thought about a measles shot clinic at this time? Or?
So with the unimmunized ones, you can't really do that because of what I told you. The ones who have only had one immunization can go back to school if they get the second, because they're unlikely to have any reaction like that. But the vast majority of kids that we're talking about are kids who have had no immunization at all.
I'm just wondering if some of those parents might have a little change of mind right now.
Well, yeah, but we're not going to count. We're still going to let those kids back. If a child who's not immunized goes in and gets a measles shot, we're still not. If they haven't had any, we're not letting them back until we're 21 days past the last potential exposure at that school. I hope a lot of people get a change of, you know, heart about this. I mean, my big fear is that we're going to have a severe, you know, given the numbers, and I'm concerned, this is exponential. So, you know, measles is that contagious. If you have a case and you have 12, you have susceptible people, each case can produce another 12 cases pretty easily. And you can just do the math.
So when they cross state lines and go into Portland, do you get the data on the people that were exposed at PDX because they came from Clark County and then they exposed a bunch of people in Multnomah County and then now we've got...
So we investigate the cases that live in Clark County. If they've been through the Portland airport, we identify that. We turn that information over to Multnomah County because that's their jurisdiction. If they end up with their own cases, they'll have to interview their own cases.
Will they let you know...
If any of their cases, so Multnomah County identifies a case, and they're interviewing the case. They're a Multnomah County resident, and the case says that they visited the Battleground Police Department. Then that would be, we'd be investigating that, and then identifying who their contacts were. You know, Multnomah County would interview the case and find out what day and what hours, since it's their resident, when they were visiting the Battleground Police Department, and then we would take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Mark, going back to your question about will they change their mind, I think as Alan was talking about, if you go and look at the post on social media, they're not going to change. Most of those people are not going to change their mind.
Really?
Well, I don't want to have a death or a child with encephalitis, but maybe some folks will if we do, I hope not. I mean, we don't see polio anymore. Think about how hard, but people just take it for granted that we don't have those diseases.
Well, I was going to say, that's some of the information I've read. They've talked about, we have a generation of parents right now that have not experienced or witnessed the impact of these diseases. And so, like, I know my parents, immunization wasn't a question. They had seen what could happen, but I think we have families now that really haven't seen that or experienced it. And I think what I'm hearing a lot, even in our building, is that you guys are overreacting. Everybody gets measles. It's not a big deal. So I just think it's, and there's also some cultural issues. You know, people that maybe don't trust our government or the information that's coming from our government. So I think there's a variety of issues, and I think we should be careful. You know, not really to blame parents who choose not to immunize their kids. That there are other factors that...
Every disease is different and approaches different. We're a bit more heavy-handed, not a bit, a lot more heavy-handed with measles than we were with chickenpox. Now, chickenpox can have some nasty complications, but not as common or frequent as measles. And, you know, mumps even less so, but... this one really scares me. And I don't think blaming anybody is good, but I think that, we need to have more community discussions
just
about this.
Just keep educating.
I think what concerns me is that we give in people information if their kids are exposed and unimmunized about, we've done what's called active surveillance. So for the people who've been unimmunized and exposed, we'll call them every day, and some folks stopped answering their phones and still take their kids to places where, if they have symptoms, they are beginning getting sick, they may infect other people. So I'm not interested in blaming, but I think there's a lot of myth out there about the seriousness of this. I think we need to counter that information because people are still going out in public.
And the test for measles, is it a quick kind of snap test, or what is the test? Is it an easy detectable?
So it's there's two tests. The most The most accurate one is a PCR, it's a genetic test on the urine or a nasopharyngeal swab.
Is that a common test that the providers can, do on a regular basis, knowing that this is?
No, it's not a common or quick test, and we send those specimens up to the state public health lab. It is not a common. It's not like a rapid strep or something like that. We send those up to the state lab. The other test you can do is an antibody test called an IgM, but it's not. It's help. You know, if you don't have anything else, that's helpful. But you can get. It's a long discussion, but you get false positive IgMs.
So are these physicians that are testing these kids? I mean, like you said, it can be like the first stages where they may be in the urgent care because they've got a bad cold, which is really the measles. How are these physicians, finding?
We actually had to send somebody back to the doctor because one of the exposed cases showed up at a doctor's office. A doctor didn't know about. This is why we get provider advisories out. This kid had was unimmunized, had been exposed to a case, to a confirmed case, had a diarrhea, which can happen with measles as well, cough and runny nose and a fever, and they diagnosed it as probable pertussis, whooping cough, and they sent the child home. We actually have sent the child, we arranged to get. You got to be careful because you want to send them to the, into the clinic. We've arranged to get some specimens on the child to send to the state public health lab for measles, and that was an education for the provider as well.
Yeah, it seems like getting these positives means that they're probably how long it takes to get the positive results means that they're just taking away and exposing more people.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's interesting. As old as I am, when you're a child, you don't remember a lot of things, but I remember having measles, and I remember how sick I was, and it was just...
You remember being in a dark room?
Oh, yes. I couldn't go outside. Your eyes just... Yeah. Oh, my God. My eyes... I stayed in the house. My mom and dad put curtains up, and it lasted forever.
A couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And then if your brothers and sisters want to give, then the next one, the next one.
Mm-hmm. And that was before there was a vaccine.
I'm with you. Yeah. I'm contemporary. Yeah.
So wasn't the measles the sugar cube? Isn't that...
That's what, polio. That was
polio. So the measles was the big scar.
No, that was smallpox. Okay. Those of us old enough to
I had both of those.
I had that.
One of the things, too, around this response is that it's not just our communicable disease team and nurses that are responding to this. Because we've called up our incident command teams, our incident management teams, we are pulling staff from across public health, and even the Department of Health is coming down as helping us with some resources. We have a Medical Reserve Corps volunteer group that's helping us. It's huge. And so as we're pulling from other areas, we have people, for instance, from environmental health that are on our incident management teams that have now been pulled from their day-to-day work in order to focus on this. So the impact is felt department-wide, and there's an impact, there is an impact on community as well because, day-to-day work gets backed up. So that falls to other people who are not on the teams that are trying to get the work done too. So it's a huge, huge undertaking, and that's, Ellen talked about foundational public health services. That's why we have to have capacity. Mm-hmm. And we were cut as thin as we are right now. It's really difficult when we have a major event like this to be able to really manage it and manage it well and manage it the way our community expects us to manage it.
And, this can go on for weeks. So it's not just a matter of, having the surge capacity right now. People are going to get pretty tired doing this, drill, depending on how this thing progresses over the next several weeks.
We're slated right now for our Nurse Family Partnership nurses to actually staff the call center, which means that all of those patient, all those client home visits are being rescheduled right now. And that's another example of kind of the impact.
And that takes the support away from the newborn mother, the mother with the newborn, and that can cause all kinds of problems there. So I understand how...
All hands on deck.
Yeah, just making the contact with the people, that's got to take forever.
Yeah, let me know if you need any of our emergency management staff to help. Or some of our EOC volunteers, we can probably...
I think Rob is on that right now. You should be expecting a call shortly.
We just went into command this morning. Yeah, Lawrence.
Do we know if the kids who come down with it, have lived in the country and could have gotten the vaccine or outside the country?
We've had some who traveled from outside the country, from an endemic country. We're probably going to get more information out about that soon. That's what, you know, the CDC had considered measles eradicated in the United States in 2000 because virtually all the cases that were seeing were acquired overseas. But we've had most of the cases now that are here acquired the case, they've been contacts and acquired it here. But there has been travel involved.
Well, you think about,
you know, this is only a plane ride away.
Well, then you think about the places in town. I think about my grandson and the places that you go, you know, like the Sky Zone and all these kids' places, you know, the castle, and, you know, you can have a kid who's been there, and then you're going to, you know, it's like the urgent care times 10, you know, with the kids in and out of those places if somebody is in there with measles.
Yeah, over the next few days, you'll be seeing more press releases. We'll be identifying, since we're up to 14 cases right now our staff are contacting them, getting a history about wherever they were during the period they might have been contagious, and we'll undoubtedly find other locations where people might have been, and we're going to have to notify the public about that.
Do you know how many exclusions you're going to have as far as kids?
I don't know the exact number, but it will be significant because some of these kids are in schools where there are fairly high rates of vaccine refusal.
These are more elementary or high school?
They're all elementary so far.
So if anyone would like to volunteer to be on incident management, just let me know.
If you all want to learn how public health is done, yeah. This is the bread and butter. I mean, but it's, if people are vaccinated, we would have to do this.
Yeah, but that's never going to happen.
No.
Not with the way people are suspicious.
Yeah, it's
kind of exactly.
All right, on to
more exciting things.
Well, I don't know about that. All right, so we're going to review the exercises that we've been doing as a FAT group and talk about where we ended up with our prioritization of our topics. So, as you all know, we've been vetting sort of the topics. We've got a diverse kind of perspectives on what we wanted to really zero in on for this year. We've gone through a process of trying to narrow down the divergent perspectives and try to figure out kind of some things that we can focus on. And we put together criteria, if you guys all recall, about, you know, how it is that we can vet these topics. Do we have data that we can bring in? Can we actually, you know, evaluate kind of what we're doing? Do we have community partners that we could bring in? Also, are the topics that we're looking at, do they fall within the purview of the Public Health Advisory Council's role to advise the Board of Health? So that, I think, was one of the criteria that was so important that we came up with. So we've been, if you recall, I'm sure you all remember, we've been through this process. But last time we did that dot exercise, as you all remember, and we figured we were looking at trying to prioritize. There were three kind of larger topic areas that we all decided on. One was safe neighborhood development. One was trauma-informed policy/ACEs education. And the third was suicide prevention, youth and adults. And the focus is still around sort of that whole, you know, gun violence kind of a thing. That's sort of an overarching umbrella over all of this. So after we went through this, we went back and we added up all of the votes, our dot votes, and suicide prevention and youth and adults came out as the top priority that we're wanting to focus on in 2019. And some of your comments when we did the discussion and also your notes that you wrote on the flippy charts was that, you know, really though, when we look at it, ACEs, education, and trauma-informed policy really underlie all these topic areas that we were talking about. So that's going to have to continue to be a piece of some of the work that we do. So that was one thing. Also, the suicide prevention for youths and adults, we felt like there were good sources of data for us to be able to go and actually look at that and be able to kind of drill down. Now, I mentioned some of the data that we're going to be getting from medical examiners and other areas. We're able to drill down on those sorts of things. The impact on this is community-wide, as we were all talking about. It impacts schools and families, youth, elderly, LGBTQ population, veterans, those with mental health or substance use issues, those sorts of things. So it really impacts community-wide, as well we discussed. And then we could also potentially, one of the things that was said is that there, we could potentially identify a lot of policy recommendations and advocate for supportive evidence-based upstream solutions. So that's one of the roles that that could play with regard to advising Board of Health about this topic. So those are the kinds of discussion points that we had at our last meeting. So the recommendation really that we've come back with is that we can focus our data around suicide, and we can use crosstabs with ACEs and social determinants of health information that we have. And for suicide trends and the manner of death and the demographics, you know, we'll be able to pull some data around that and also identify those potential policy recommendations. So we do feel like this will be a rich area of being able to really dive down and present a lot of information around this topic and be able to figure out some things that you all can work on, not only if you wanted to work in task forces or whatever, but really to present and advise the Board of Health on some policy changes that could really impact the community. So the idea around this is too, is that we'll continue to bring, it's not just that we're gonna focus only on this area, we had mentioned that before, we're gonna continue to bring important and emerging public health topics to FAC. I mean, the whole measles discussion is part of that. Even though our focus is going to be on suicide prevention with gun violence overlaying this whole thing. And we really wanted to spend a little bit of time to identify some presenters tonight. And I think you had mentioned that earlier that you wanted to have this conversation as part of our discussion. Last time we talked about ACEs Action Alliance, and Joan, you brought up that ACEs is doing a lot of work around this, and ACEs as it relates to suicide and suicide prevention is something that we could certainly bring to them or bring here. The Children's Justice Center, Joan, I think you talked about this too, that they had presented costs associated with abuse, which leads to ACEs, which leads to, you know, all kinds of other issues. And they presented that to the ACEs Action Alliance. So that's something that we could potentially bring them in around as well. The Youth Commission. So now we got a contact, so we're going to be
all right.
Education leaders. So we certainly brought in, you know, a couple of education leaders before. We've had some conversations from Wendy Dunaway, is that her last name? And then also Deb Drandoff from ESD 112, who presented on some of the work that they're doing around that risk mitigation for youth. So we can continue doing that. Council on Aging was mentioned, which we definitely have some opportunities there as well. The VA, also David's team, and David's actually going to present tonight for us on an update on the child death review, as well as the community priority project. And then we can also work with our epidemiologists to pull some data around that suicide data and really do those deep dives. And so we'll be able to bring them on board as well. So not just community presenters, but also our own staff to be able to present some of the data. Yes.
I'd like to suggest that NAMI, Southwest Washington, be contacted.
Yeah.
They do provide mental health services to, I think, virtually anybody that walks in the door and says, I need some help. Peggy McCarthy, the executive director, came in when NAMI had just, people didn't even talk about NAMI, it was gone. And she came in and she turned that whole organization around by utilizing consumers that had mental health issues mm-hmm. themselves. And also the family members, it has always historically been for family members and significant other friends, whatever, people with mental health issues. But what Peggy did was she got the consumers in there working, you know, answering the phones, creating the different projects or activities or whatever. I think they just did something like 1,000 rocks or whatever. And if you see a little pretty painted rock around town just sitting somewhere, somebody at NAMI did that. But they also have the DNA testing to see if people can actually metabolize the medications that they're being given. And that's very helpful. My understanding is that it can be very helpful. Not for everybody, but for those persons that have a difficult time with certain medications, you know, they can find out what would be more effective. They have, I know Peggy does yoga with people, but they've got different people in there from pharmacy, from medical, from, they just lost the one of my favorite people that provided mental health services, Janet Raven. She was with Columbia River for years and years and years, and then she went there, she retired. But they've got a lot of things going on there, and many people turn to NAMI, you know, when they've got a child or adult child or a parent. And I think we would be amiss if we did not at least have them come in and talk with us.
Absolutely, and I think I have Peggy's contact information, so we can definitely add those to this. So I think that's important to also talk about resources. So we want to bring data, we want to talk about it, but we also want to understand what the resources are that are out there, because that will also help us to advocate and to, you know, advise the Board of Health. There may be some things that NAMI's doing that we also may identify as things that we want to advocate for. So.
No, we should have yoga before yoga? We eat.
That could be our next activity. Awesome, right?
Roxanne, I still am advocating that we hear from Kate Budd on the county's plan for homeless.
I forgot to add that to the list, yes, but I have her on the list. Yeah, for housing, right?
Well, for the homeless action plan for Clark County.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the county council just recently approved it, but it's really important for us to know. Because we know that, you know, ACEs, there's a lot of links to that in terms of violence and the health of our community. So I think we need to hear that report sooner rather than later.
Yeah, when you've mentioned that twice to me, two or three times now, so we'll get her on the agenda early on. I actually was talking to Andy Silver the other day. I know that he's not associated with, well, he's still associated with it, but he's not the director. Kate Budd took his position, and I was talking to him about that the other day. So, yeah, we'll definitely get her on as well. Who else? Anybody else? Any other thoughts? We have a great list going, and which is super helpful. It's helpful for me to understand, too, as we're talking to community partners, where your interest lies. So if you have any other thoughts or suggestions,
I know that Janus Youth is an organization that our school is working with.
Okay.
And for Interact Club, we're focusing on ending sex trafficking, and I think that plays a great role in mental health. And so I feel like the problem is that we had a booth in front of our ASB office, but many people aren't really wanting to seek that like higher level of education, or think that it's a waste of time. So I think that we can advertise it more.
But
what's the name?
Janus
Youth. Janus? Janus, J-A-N-U-S. Janus Youth.
Janus, J-A-N-U-S. Do you have contact information that I could work with you on?
I think I can email Elizabeth from Youth
Commission. That'd be great. Thank you. Awesome. Okay. Well, I'm very excited, and I think that this is going to be a good year. So the next steps, what we're going to be doing now, is really starting to drill down on this. We'll continue to talk about this. We'll be bringing some data. We'll be bringing some community partners in. We'll start to identify some things that rise to the surface as things that you feel like we could advise the Board of Health around. And we'll help with that too. I mean, we'll be bringing some information. We also want to make sure that it aligns with what the Board of the counselors' agendas are as well. So we're keeping our eye on that to make sure that we have, when there are opportunities, we can bring those to you as well. And then we'll continue to focus on bringing these community partners in to educate, not just around this topic though. I mean, again, I just want to emphasize that it's not going to be just like a one topic thing the whole year. So we'll continue to do that. And then if there's any issues that you feel are emerging issues that are coming forth, please let us know as well. And we've got David tonight that's going to talk about the Community Priorities Project as well as the Child Death Review. Child Death Review is one area where we're going to be getting data for the work that we're going to be doing. And he's just recently convened the first panel, so he's got some cool information to share with you.
Roxanne, one other thing that we've talked about, and it's again, is the status of the Growing Healthier report.
Yep.
And it's probably some work that we could spend some time at a meeting, you know, in terms of where do we still, is there still work that we need to do on it, or, but I mean, I think it's really important that we do that. It was so important when we did it, and, you know, as the county continues to grow, we should keep it on the front shelf and not let it be buried as just great work that we did.
Yeah. One of the things that we're doing too with the new counselors that are coming on board, so we have Temple Lentz that is now on board, and we've got a schedule orientation with her coming up. And then I expect that the vacated seat from counselor, council chair inquiring is going to be filled. I think it's by the end of this month, right, Alan?
I believe so.
It's supposed to be filled. So we have another, who knows who that will be, so we'll have another new counselor. And I think that's an opportunity to really talk to them about this work, the work, and then I think that will also help with, you know, getting it back on the radar as well. I think it's kind of, you know, it was sort of buried in the growth management plan, you know, because the health element was kind of taken out of that and sort of torn apart, but yeah, put in their places around it. But to your point, we need to make sure that that's still understood.
Yeah.
And the work is understood.
And we're going to be going through it again in the future. Yeah. And it's absolutely, like, we want to make it a living document, not something that we did at one point in time. It was great and we put it up there. It's like we should be, you know, staying on top of that and then continuing to refine it so that the next time we go through the comprehensive growth plan, it's better, you know.
One of the things too that we're doing, to your point, is with regard to resources, we're continuing to work with the county manager to try to see. I mean, we're having a significant budget challenge right now, as you guys have all heard, but we're really working with them to try to make sure that we can get resources for those, exactly those sorts of things. That was very exciting when we were able to do that. We had a dedicated resource who was really an urban planner that was able to do a lot of that work for us. We just don't have that resource anymore, but we're trying to get back there. We really are. So this is a priority for us as well. And I think that revisiting it is always a good idea. So.
What about SWATCH?
SWATCH?
Mm-hmm. The community health workers.
Oh,
and Daniel Smith gives a really good presentation about what it is they're trying to do.
Yeah.
You might think about asking him to come in.
They are awesome. And
they are.
Actually, we have several people that are from the public health department that actually are working very closely with Southwest ACH.
Mm-hmm.
And the Community Health Worker Project, we've been involved with Healthy Living Collaborative for a long time. And we're really, really excited about that work and that it's really now continued to grow and we're looking at ways of sustaining it going forward. And the Rose Village team has done a tremendous job around housing and some other things. So I think that we definitely can bring it in. There's a couple of really dynamic people that I know we're always tapping on the shoulder, but a few of them have actually gone up to the Olympia and they were really integral to getting a lot of the housing legislation passed. And if it wasn't for them telling the stories, I don't think that it would have passed. So,
I don't know if you guys know that, but Roxanne is chair of the SWATCH board.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yay. I apparently cannot say no to anything. So.
She's very modest.
I will have some, I got some ins at SWATCH now, uh-huh. So we'll be able to.
I thought Kachina. So Kachina's no longer.
Kachina's actually still there. She's leaving in June to go. She's moving to Eugene with her husband, they've also got some family in that area. And I think her husband has been working for.
He's the staff person for the Speaker of the Oregon House,
yeah.
Tina Kotek, but he's going into academia at University of Oregon, I think.
And that's the politics, so they're going to Eugene. Anyway, we will miss Kachina, but she's putting into place a really good structure that's going to fit, that work is going to continue. So
you already know what Daniel's presentation looks like.
Yes. Okay.
Okay,
very good. Thank you.
Sorry.
No, I appreciate that. Are there any more before I hand it over to David? Are there any other suggestions? These are all great. And if you have anything else that you think about, please feel free to email me one time and we'll add it.
All right, so I was here, some of you remember, back in the fall to talk about this project, and so I know we have some new members, so I'm going to kind of give a quick overview. So this is a project that the epidemiologists in our department are leading and really looking at local, state, and national data to identify where our priority communities are. We did this about 8 years ago and identified Central Vancouver as having some of the highest health disparities, and that's why we focused so much of our work there recently. But we know that during those last 8 years, there's been not only a population increase, but also a lot of demographic changes, and we know that just also from the school data that we've seen. So what we're doing now is not only identifying communities in Clark County with the highest health disparities, but also looking at what are the issues within communities. So you can see from this one pager that I passed out, we're gonna create a community profile that'll look at different demographic factors along with some of the social determinants of health. And then on the backside of this sheet are the health topics that we're gonna drill into. So we are in the process right now of creating some data reports on these six topic areas, and we will have those ready in April. And then from there, we're gonna come up with a more of a full report, which will include the community profile along with all of the data sheets on these six topics. And then we probably will go into a phase two later in the fall based on the reaction from the community and partners and the needs they have around this data. So I just wanted to provide you with that update on that project and let you know kind of where things are at. So we're pretty much on target because we had planned to release something early part of 2019.
You know, that was an interesting article in the Columbian looking at where, you know, how healthy your life span, and I mean, it was all based on the data. I don't know if people read that, but you know, they featured I can't remember the fourth one of the neighborhoods along Fourth Plain, and then compared it with neighborhood in Camas, and it's the disparities are tremendous.
Did you bring that up because I was in the article? So I was interviewed for that.
Yeah. But I think it'd be good because that's what we're talking about.
Yes,
you know,
it's true. Yeah. Any other questions about that? All right, so I'll move on to child death review. So that's another topic I came and talked with you about last fall. So this is looking at all unnatural deaths, and we have convened a group of experts from various disciplines. So we have a core team that includes, as Alan mentioned, the medical examiner's office, obviously public health, we have a pediatrician, we have someone from the prosecuting attorney's office, ESD 112, the Cowlitz tribe, EMS, law enforcement, and then we also have some ad hoc members from the fire department, Clark County Fire and Rescue, maternal child health, domestic violence, substance abuse treatment, and court-appointed special advocate. So we had, since I presented to you last time, we had our first meeting in early December. We had about 25 to 30 people there. It was both a training, but we also reviewed two cases. The training was done, we were really fortunate to have the Associate Director of the National Center for Prevention and Fatality Review from Washington, D.C. that came out. So she was has done this many times, and she kind of led the discussion. And we had a group from Oregon in Columbia County across the river that was there because they're also starting up a child death review team there, so they came for the training. And then we reviewed two cases that we had selected. One was suicide related, and the other one as a traffic accident. So we in advance of the meeting, we got all the reports that we could about these cases, and then we reviewed them. Being the first meeting, even with the outreach we didn't get all the reports we needed. There was a lot of things missing. I think some of the partners didn't really realize what they were supposed to bring, but we still had a very rich discussion. The suicide was firearm related. So
The purpose of child death review is really to look at prevention. That's really our focus. And you know, one of the kind of goals of child death review nationally is that it's really a community responsibility to prevent child death, right? So that's really the focus of the discussion is on prevention. So what we're doing now is we're looking into where guns are sold, any kind of like gun shows, you know, the lockbox event that the Prevent Coalition does. We're looking at the education that's done around gun safety and looking at potential policies that we can put in place that gun safety education is provided across the county in different locations and in different events. And in this particular case, there was a gun lock and it was not used. So that's really why we're looking into why wasn't it used? Was it a lack of education? The traffic accident, again, we didn't have a lot of information. There's still a lot of holes. We're working with these partners to determine the information that we need, but you know, factors like was a mother driving with a young child? Was it the road conditions? Was it poor signage? Was there issues going on with a mother? So again, we're looking into it currently, and then when we come back in April, we're gonna have quarterly meetings. We're gonna have more information about these two cases and really dive into the prevention efforts that we can put in place. So as we talked about earlier, and I think Adrian asked this, unnatural deaths include, as I've talked about, suicide. That's really the number one reason for unnatural child deaths from our 2017 data here in Clark County. But it also can include sudden infant death, poisonings, traffic accidents, and falls. Those are some of the more common issues of why we're seeing child deaths. So we had asked the group whether they want to review all deaths for a particular year or if they want to focus on certain areas. And they want to think about it, and when we come back in April, they're going to let us know, because we really want coming from them what they want. So we would probably, what we would do is, I know we're going to talk about suicide, so we would probably focus a meeting entirely on suicides and review 3 to 4 cases.
Yeah. David, when you say children, what's the age group here?
It's, you know, newborns to 19. And then what we do is there's a national database at Michigan Public Health Institute, and we send all of our data into there, and we'll get our data back, and then we can compare it to national data. And then in terms of confidentiality, everyone signs a confidentiality agreement that none of the information shared during the review goes out of the room, and then any reports that are distributed are all collected at the end of the meeting. So they're not distributed.
Yeah. Hey, David, with this national database, where we're comparing our data to a national data set, is there information also about what the other national child death review panels have come up with regarding prevention and policy level opportunities for
kids? It's through that, but also through this National Center for Prevention and Fatality Review. They also have been very helpful. And we're also in touch with the other child death coordinators in Washington State. So we have regular calls with them through Department of Health.
Do you have any approximate numbers of, like, for 2018, like, how many cases would there have been?
Yeah, so I don't have 2018 data, but in 2017 there were 25. Yeah.
So that would include all suicides?
Yes, and the other
issues. Yeah. Give the age range?
Yeah, it's newborn to age 19.
But the 25 weren't all suicides.
Oh, suicides, I don't offhand. Okay. No, I could get that for you.
You know, I ask only because right now we have a national problem with young men 19 to like 24.
Right.
They're just lost. They're lost. They don't know what to do. They graduate high school, they don't know what to do. We've had the fellow on the I-5 bridge. We've had people doing all kinds of really horrible things to themselves. And I'll be very interested to find out you know, the age range or whatever of the suicides, and I think that will, I think the work that we do on the suicide will help us find out about these young men in our community, because I get called, I had three calls today about young men in our community that are struggling, that just don't know what to do.
So, Melanie, just to clarify, though, for child death review, it's only newborns to age 19.
Okay,
we won't
okay.
be looking at anybody.
But you got the 19, you got the 18 and 19 year old in there.
Yeah.
And,
but
just,
however, there's other sources of data that we have that really speak to
right.
that other age group. So, I mean, there's going to be other, you know, other sources that we can take a look at.
And we're not just focusing on youth suicide, we're looking at
adult and
adults
youth,
as well.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just, it just,
yeah.
I've got one over there, you know. And when I hear about these other young men and I talk to them and I talk to their parents and I'm going to these meetings with them and they are just absolutely lost, and we've got this whole, you know, the marijuana is legal, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing about anybody, but there's all kinds of things that we didn't really have before that kids are doing, and it just terrifies me because they don't have mentors, or they don't have fathers, or they don't have whatever. But I'm sorry, I'll get off my soapbox. That's just my little soapbox there. I'm sorry.
And the group, I must, the people that are on this, in this group, how many people are on?
There's probably 20 to 25 in total.
Okay.
Yeah. But that includes the ad hoc members. So that would be, we'd only pull them in if the cases we're going to review, like let's say domestic violence,
mm-hmm.
if there was domestic violence involved with a particular
mm-hmm.
death,
mm-hmm.
they'd be called in. Otherwise, they wouldn't attend the meeting.
These are all
volunteers. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, David. So we'll be presenting some more information around Child Death Review and Community Priorities Project, and then Marjorie, to your point, we'll be pulling in data from a variety of different sources so that we can really look at this and say, okay, what is the breadth of the problem, and what, and we can slice it and dice it. And what's really cool is all the cross tabulations that we can do with this data to really get nuances around kind of what is really happening. So it's not just an age range, it's really looking at some additional factors, risk factors that we can pull into it, which I think will be super helpful for our discussion going forward.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Right. Any other questions on that?
And good work.
Thank you.
Good work.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're moving on down to the executive committee, and we're going to vote on the 2019 officers and the executive board nominees. I think we presented those at the November, so everybody's aware of what the nominating committee came to with the following recommendations. I was nominated to be the chair again, which is very nice. And then Marla Sanger was nominated to be the vice chair, and Remy Houston was nominated to be the member at large as well. So, and are we voting? Mm-hmm. Need to vote? Okay, do you want me to take the vote?
So if you just want to go ahead and, you know, motion to accept.
Okay, so it seems weird to have a motion to accept myself. But.
Yeah.
I move that we cast a unanimous ballot for the slate of officers proposed by the nominating committee.
Oh, that I like that. Nice job. I'm going to get her done.
It's Robert's rule.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Is there any discussion?
I second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. So moved. We're doing all three.
Congratulations.
Perfect. Thank you.
And Marla's in Tucson right now, but she'll be at the next meeting. So, and she knows she's not. I'll be a good shot.
Not a long time.
Guess what?
Yeah.
You know what? There's
going to
be more meetings.
Well, happy to serve. You know, that was an interesting evening. So thanks for.
Thank you.
I'll work with you. And there is an open path position that Roxanne will be.
So we've got two open positions right now. One is still in education, and the other one is for legacy. So we've been working for a while on that. The education opening. Sandy Mathewson resigned her position here, and that's the education position. So we sent out a press release. We haven't gotten anybody to respond. That's actually, we've got actually a lot of responses, but nobody's in education, unfortunately, and that's the area that we need. So we're going to be working with some of our contacts with ESD 112 and some of the school districts to see if they have anybody that they could potentially recommend. If you know of anybody that's in the educational realm that would be interested in the opportunity, you're welcome to share that with them, and they can go online and take a look at it for the Public Advisory Council. And all they need to do is just submit a letter of interest and give us a little bit of background about themselves and what they're interested, and they can throw in a resume if they want to. And we can get that position settled. I think with Legacy right now, they're just looking at who on their sort of leadership team level could potentially replace. And it was Kelly Espinosa who resigned, I think, last year. So we've had that opening for a while. So we're diligently working on that. But the education, we're trying to kind of broaden the recruitment. If you know of anybody that would be interested, please let them know. And they can certainly contact either myself or Lydia with any questions. Okay, so hopefully we'll have some additional new members, and Katie won't be our newest member after that. All right.
Are there any council member updates?
I have something. I just want to make sure everybody knows that last week, January 8th, was the grand opening of Bridgeview Resource Center. It's linked to the Housing Authority. It's located up in Skyline Crest. It's a employment and education resource center for any low-income client in the community. And it's driven by the partners that provide services there. It's a fabulous community resource, so that if you know somebody who's looking for some kind of help, it's meant to be sort of a one-stop shopping for services to meet some of the needs of our low-income community. When we started the planning, we had a diagram of a single mom who we called Jill, and we showed a map of the county where all the places where Jill might go for help, and that we're changing that map so that if Jill needs resources, she can come to Bridgeview. We will have partners providing services there. And if we don't have the services there, it will be a warm handoff to somebody, a person-to-person with the bus ticket, et cetera, so that when the person goes to a resource and has to spend the time and the effort to get there, there will be somebody there that's expecting them, and they are not going to end up going down a dead end, which is what we've heard in all the focus groups from a lot of our low-income people, is that they get referred to a lot of dead ends, and so they go here, here, and here. So trying to bring it together. So it's, and the way that, you know, we got $1.7 million from the legislature to build the center. We have about 40 partners right now participating in services. There's actually a credit union there that targets low-income people who may have had trouble with banking or getting loans, etc. And so one of the things, there'll be a lot of financial education. So if anybody's interested, you could stop by Bridgeview, and you know, there are people that could tell you more about the program and, you know, walk through the building. It is a fabulous building. A lot of organizations are using it for meetings right now, but it's not meant to be a meeting place. But it's getting people familiar with what the possibilities are. If you want to offer services to clients, if you want to have a class, something, offer something to clients, especially those low-income clients, you'll be able to use the center. You have to be a partner to do that, and then it's easy to sign up to be a partner.
Where is that, John?
It's in Skyline Crest, 505 Omaha Way, okay. Right off Andreessen.
Okay.
Next to the Boys and Girls Club.
Okay.
And they have done a really good job with Skyline Crest redoing those.
Oh, yeah, it's part of a big plan.
I mean, they are nice hardwood floors, and I mean, it used to be such a
Well, the whole
scary
Skyline
place.
Crest is just a whole. Not only the remodeling of all the homes that are up there, the 140 some homes, there's the Boys and Girls Club, and the mm-hmm. kids that live in that community, they only pay $5 a year to go to the Boys, to be a member of the Boys and Girls Club. So many of them are latchkey kids, and so it's a place that they can go after school. And then, so there's the Bridgeview Resource Center, and then where the Rise and Stars Community Center was located, that has been torn down. And there's actually a three-story building, the Caples Terrace, which is almost open. It'll open later this year. And it is going to be housing for kids aging out of foster care. a lot of those kids that you talk about that are lost, they'll be case managed, and of course the Bridgeview Resource Center will just be there, but they will actually it'll be case managed. It'll be sort of like a Lincoln Place, but for kids aging out of foster care, with support services available, so that hopefully it'll get them onto a more sustainable, positive future than what happens. They just.
Joan, what was the name of that again? I didn't hear that.
Bridgeview.
Yeah, Bridgeview, and then the
Caples Terrace.
Caples Terrace.
Caples Terrace.
Oh, okay.
After D.L. Wood Caples, who was one of the founders of the Vancouver Housing Authority, first board members.
Thank you.
Do you know if they have any veterinary resources that
they don't, but that would be interesting to consider that. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly.
Has a really good couple of different really good resources for homeless and
spay and neuter.
I know that Clark County, not Clark County, but the Humane Society, or Clark County Humane Society, like that, but anyways, they do offer some.
Yeah, and so if somebody wanted to have like a fair on a Saturday where people could, low-income people.
Vaccine clinics and things.
Yes, et cetera. We've got space for that. Lots of classrooms and lots of donors who help make this happen. So, and then the other thing I wanted to mention is January 24th, next Thursday, is Project Homeless Connect, and it's also the point-in-time homeless count in Clark County. And as we're we're not seeing a decrease in the issues of homelessness in our community. We're seeing an increase. And people say, well, there's all these apartments going up.
They can't afford them.
They are market rate. There's a lot of the newer properties that are going up they're too expensive for people who have who are lower income. So the crisis is still alive and well.
We still have families and cars. I have one. As you know, Sam has been driving me to my meetings lately, and as we took on Click Attack in Southwest Washington, I have been allowed to hire my son so he doesn't just drive me for free anymore. He's actually on the payroll now and is an assistant to the ombuds, and so he grew up sitting on the floors in this building and in the C Street building and many others. And so by nothing but osmosis, he has learned about mental health and substance use disorder and recovery visions and other things that, you know, other things I've been involved in. And so he has joined. We now have an ombuds team. After 14 years, we have to get an ombuds team. So I'm very excited about that. I'm excited because it was something that he was interested in doing, and it's just part-time, so he gets to rock and roll all he wants, but I just wanted to let you all know that Sam is an official part of the Southwest Washington Behavioral Health Ombuds team.
Good.
Couple things I'd like to talk about. Number one is, we had a lot of conversations about gun safety in here, and so one of the things listened to everybody, went back, and we've been working on this for a while, but we finally made a little pamphlet. So when you come to the battleground and you get your CPL license through us, we'll give you a pamphlet, and it's now a little card, like kind of like what county does, so it's not a paper one anymore. But when you open it up, it'll actually have a talk about Project Child Safe and how guns are dangerous in the hands of children and things that can happen. And we talk about storage and handling tips. And then right underneath where the license is, it's your responsibility to know the gun rules and refer you to the RCW. And then we put our mission, vision, and values on the back of it. So Now when you come in, you get a CPL in our police department, this will get mailed to you with the license. So that's one of the things thanks to just the conversation in here, I said, that's a good idea to have something that we give out to our community members. Another thing that law enforcement council is having a meeting with Judge Zimmerman on Thursday, and we're going to start having a conversation about, with some grant money, doing what's called, and I know I've heard these before, but I didn't know it had an acronym, but DCR, a Designated Crisis Responders Unit. So there's four other places in the state that have them: Yakima, Tri-Cities, Spokane, and then Pierce County. So we'll be probably the fifth, and that will be will actually have grant money to have clinicians ride with police officers in the county of Clark. It can be, they could ride in the city or wherever they're assigned. But if an officer anywhere in the county gets a mental health call, they'll respond to the scene, they'll take it over, and they'll do the triage right there. And if they have to take the person, transport them somewhere, that'll free up the patrol officer, and they're going to do that. So that's something we're looking at doing. Which, everywhere they've had it in the state so far has been positive. And then just to give you a little personal background on things that are happening, we talk about mental health all the time, but we have one community member in our community with severe mental health problems. She ends up having a mental health crisis. Her first time we ever had contact with her, she drove around a road closed sign when we were doing slurry sealing, and drove down the road and did about $5,000 worth of damage to the slurry seal as the guys are trying to get the road done. She's putting tire tracks in it. So that was our first contact with her. And then our second contact was a drunk driver. And then our third contact was she just kind of racing around crazy, and we tried to stop her, and then we realized who it was, and we let her go because we're not going to chase her around and kill somebody. So they're her husband, who's trying to do the best he can, trying to get resources for her. They took the car keys away from her, hid the car keys. Well, they go to church on Sunday. She ransacks the house, finds the car keys, and her goal in life was to go. She drove around town looking for a battleground police car to crash into because she needed to have. She wanted mental health services. Well, she couldn't find one, so she came over to the police station and drove through our security gates. Both security gates destroyed them. Pull in the back of the secure parking lot, and they call 911 and ask for a police officer. So this is like at this point, we booked her for felony vandalism, knowing the fact that, hey, she needs to get some court-ordered help because it's kind of getting out of control for us, and also knowing the fact that, she's not going to, the insurance is not going to cover her damages because it was an intentional act. So it's just the kind of, and that's one person out of, a dozen I could talk about just in the city battleground, that constant contacts. Mm-hmm. And you don't have the resources, and even with a family trying to help you, there's nothing really you can do. And the only safe time we have, which is sad, is from the moment she's incarcerated until she's released, we can all take a breath for a minute, but she'll get released and do it all over again. And luckily, next time it's not an officer driving down the street and she runs into an officer 80 miles an hour, and then have something bad happen. So,
and you can always have the families or the individual contact me as far as timely access to quality services. I mean, that's what I do.
Okay. So I just want to give you, that's what's going on in the world of mental health services.
Is that pamphlet available on the website?
This pamphlet? Not yet, but I can get it out there. I will do that. This is my only copy. This is I'm carrying around. So, hey, this is 8 years. Look at it. One thing the police chief
accomplished. Nice.
So, Bob, let me give you my phone number.
Okay.
It's 360-606-1040 or 360-397-8470.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll get some new, I'm making a new brochure because Clickitat has come on board. And so as soon as I get that, I'll bring it probably to the next meeting you'll all have. A new brochure.
So Bob, can I just ask a question? So I know that Clark County, right now has DCRs the new program is going to be that they can do ride-alongs with them?
Well, I think, the new program is they're actually riding with officers in the field. And I've just glanced at the emails because it's kind of we're just now starting to have conversations. But it looks like they're given a bulletproof vest and radio. And then the way it looks like to me is they'll ride with another officer. And that unit will be – what I recommend that they do is they look at calls for service for mental health calls. Maybe talk to the health department and their embryologist, because the health department is looking at CAD data. Mm-hmm. So we could figure out where we can staff these units where they make the most, most bang for the buck. And then what it looks like will happen, even if it's a Vancouver officer or a battleground or whoever, that officer will get dispatched anywhere in the county that needs that service. Okay. And they'll take over the call. Okay. And so that officer the other officer can leave, and they'll take over the whole thing to do the transport. Those kinds of things. That's how I I envision Oregon, but that could change. Yeah. But well, that's what we're looking at doing. Because the problem we have, like everybody else, is you get what happens is you get involved in all these things, and you can be there all day mm-hmm. because you just can't find a we've driven around before, and, you know, trying to find so where can we take a body, mm-hmm. It hasn't changed. I remember we had the same issue in Orange County. Orange County down in Southern California, we had 3.5 million people, and we had 10 mental health beds in the county for 3.5 million people. You could never find a bed. So we learned two things. Number one is you have to if you really needed to get somewhere, you would and it wasn't an emergency. We'd drive all the way up into LA County and go to Norwalk, because that was the closest facility, because we didn't have a licensed psychiatric board in the county for a private hospital, or we would take it to the ER room, drop them off, and say this person's got a medical problem, and we just call the workaround, because you're trying to, mm-hmm. Because we drive, you know, you could have somebody in your car for an hour and a half, 2 hours driving around just trying to find a facility, so we're trying to avoid that now. So
I don't know if you all are aware of this, but Station 2 closed for its temporary.
Suspended operations.
There you go. Thank you. And that is very sad. And that's a huge loss to us. But it's my understanding that Rainier Springs on 100 off 134th is now taking Medicaid individuals.
Okay. Just and also so involuntary you know. Treatment act.
But we hope that Station 2 will be back up and running very soon.
All right, any other council member updates? All right. Say we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.